man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Iffy Wadiway. I'm feeling good, but I'm feeling even better because I have so many friends in the booth with me. First up, we have film reviews editor at The Wrap, Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what's good?
Well, Iffy, I don't know if you've heard, but it's the most wonderful time of the goddamn year. and I am loving the, just there's Christmas around every corner. I'm touching it, I'm smelling it, I'm tasting it.
With consent.
With consent, yes, always. And McDonald's, bless their hearts, they're giving me a cinnamon cookie latte right now that I'm all about. And even more so, the Snickerdoodle McFlurry.
Ooh.
Well, tell us about it, because I've seen the pictures and I've dreamed, but I'm afraid to venture.
It is like, it is these, you know, like the crunchy bits of cinnamon cookie. Mm. I want to say maybe there's some chocolate chips in there too. I'm not sure, but I think it all happened so fast.
Majestic.
You know? Anyway, I just, you know, December in general, I'm in my element. This is my time. My time is now. But thank you, McDonald's, for like pouring out the holiday treats for me. I'm there for it.
Oh, yeah. I usually like their holiday pie, which I'm not seeing around, but it has custard instead of the apple pie filling.
And sprinkles.
Yes, it slaps. next up, that snort came from producer and film festival programmer Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
Slaps. What's good with me is actually a book that came recommended to me on Twitter from one of our listeners, who's one of our friends. Their name is Vic Shaka Populous, and I might be saying it wrong, but I just finally finished it. It's called Hither Page by an author, Kat Sebastian, and it's so wonderful. The sort of tagline of it is Agatha Christie, but make it gay. And it's set like in a small snowy village in England just post World War II, and a soldier who's the town doctor is returned home, and he's handsome and wonderful and kind of eyeing up this new stranger that he suspects might be a spy, probably because he is a spy, and sparks fly, and there's mystery and romance.
Make it a Hallmark TV show.
I mean, I was so swoony. And so if you are traveling for the holidays and looking for a nice quick little read, Hither Page, it just like, they were very right in making the recommendation. I quite enjoyed it.
And that other voice you hear is freelance writer whose work can be read on The Hollywood Reporter, Teen Vogue, Playboy, and many others, being retweeted by celebrities. And then those celebrities are written up. It's Joelle Monique. What's good?
Hey. Yay. The new Harley Quinn animated TV show.
Ooh.
Oh, which okay. I'm not sure if anyone here would ever want to watch. But if you enjoyed the classic Batman the Animation style animation.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But wanted it to be wicked violent, have like a hard bent feminist lean, and Harley like really cracks bones with her hammer. Chef's kiss. It is so good, except that they're queer baiting us right now, and I'm really hoping eventually lesbians will happen. I feel it. We're going to get it one day. Not
eventually,
even one.
Lesbians will happen.
But the Harley and the Ivy when they are both full grown.
Yes! Sing it! So season two, hopefully lesbians, but for now, great costumes, amazing performances, beautiful art, and blood and curse words. It's perfect.
Oh, yeah, lock me in.
Iffy, what's good?
Alonzo and I have been pacing around each other.
What's good with me is I just got back from New York, which was great because it snowed before I came and after I came. I was able to completely avoid it. But also, you know, on the way back, you know, on the way there I was playing Pokemon, but I forgot my charger back in L.A., so I couldn't play it. And I was like, you know what? Let me pop in and watch some of these films. And, you know, I knocked out films that I would have otherwise. I saw Venom. And What Men Want. And
oh.
Yeah. and what was the third? Oh, Stuber.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Those are some airplane movies.
Yeah. Because I was like, you know, why go see something that I would see on my own? And actually, What Men Want. So, like, surprisingly, I liked it the most out of the three. Venom was great. I didn't like that they, like, teased Carnage because they blew their load on Carnage because Riot essentially is Carnage. Stuber was great. It was fine.
Stuber
was great. Said no one ever until Iffy.
I was like, it's great, like a zero, and then it just progressively, this is superior, this is excellence.
It's better than staring at a blank screen for the next 90 minutes.
I love me some Batista. You put Batista there, and he's great.
It's a good cast.
Yeah. it was a good cast.
I've not seen it, but
put
it's
to
a
waste.
Movie. Yeah.
That sure is a film.
Yeah. but speaking of films, today we're talking about Queen and Slim. We'll be chatting about Black Christmas with co-writer and former host April Wolf.
Who?
And of course, our staff picks. But first, it's time for our new segment called Itadic. Is this important? Do I care? Each of us will read a new segment and answer the question, is this important? Do I care? And the first thing up, the Golden Globes nominations were announced this past week. And once again, Hollywood Foreign Press did not nominate a single female director for the Best Director category. This comes off of a particularly strong year for female directed films like Hustlers, Queen and Slim, Little Women, Honey Boy, Booksmart, and The Farewell. Like, so they even had white women if you didn't want people of color. You know? those were all directed by women, and for some reason, you know, I don't know. But if you don't know, the Globes are voted on by 100 members of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. And Alma Harrell, director of Honey Boy, had this to say. I was on the inside for the first time this year. These are not our people, and they do not represent us. Do not look for justice in the award systems. We are building a new world. Is this important? Do you care?
If I may, just to start, as you guys may or may not know, I've worked for the Golden Globes for the last 6 years. Oh. I work for Dick Clark Productions on the show itself. But one thing that always kills me, because it is a source of livelihood for me, but it's also a ridiculous show. And the Hollywood Foreign Press, she's right when she says, these are not our people and they do not represent us. That goes for numerous. The HFPA is like, it's not even 100. It's like 87 foreign journalists who are all big celebrity fans. And they do a lot of this with the thought of the night itself, of who are we going
to
be in the room with?
Oh,
yeah.
My
like,
gosh.
There's a reason that The Tourist with Johnny Depp got a nomination a few years ago. Or, like, I know that Alonso liked Where Did You Go, Bernadette,
but yeah,
Kate
that's
Blanchett
about getting Kate Blanchett
getting,
at your
yeah,
dinner.
Like,
yeah.
So the Golden Globes is not a harbinger of actual talent or awards worthiness, but it happens to be at the start of our award season, so it gets conflated a lot.
Drea,
of like
Drea, because of her connection to the Globes, is being kind. These are junket whores who like it is all about it is the International Selfie Association.
Oh, wow.
They want lunches with George Clooney and they want them now, and that's what these nominations are always about. They will always draw in these kind of what the hell, where did that come from nomination, because it means this star is going to show up at our dinner.
Yeah.
But what I find astonishing is that Olivia Wilde is not like an attractive lady that you want on your red carpet.
See, that's what I was saying. You need more iffies, because definitely Awkwafina, Alma, all of them would have been there. There'd be
Awkwafina is nominated.
Okay, cool.
No, you're talking about Lulu Wang for the director.
Lulu Wang.
Sure.
All of them. There'd be no men at my Golden Globes.
You know, I mean, you know, Greta Gerwig is like, Greta Gerwig and Olivia Wilde, like two actress turned directors. You would think that if the Globes are going to be celebrity minded about this, I mean, yeah, they're indie celebrities or TV celebrities, or but still, like,
truthfully, Little Women did seem like the kind of, to me, that was more of a bait project than anything else.
Oh, yeah.
I find it fascinating that Parasite ended up in a number. It's in Best Director.
Yeah.
It's in, I think it might even be in Screenplay. It's in a lot of categories that traditionally international films have not been.
Unless they're directed by Roberto Benigni.
Yes. who's an alien, so it's really not even the same thing. But they, the sort of like, oh, we're going to acquiesce to, what's our other? Well, no women, but we'll have the South Korean director.
So there's been a ton of speculation about the validity of Clint Eastwood's new film, Richard Jewell, which covers the real life events of the 1996 Atlanta Olympic bombing. Much of the controversy surrounds Olivia Wilde's depiction of real life Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Kathy Scruggs. In the film, it is strongly implied that Scruggs exchanges sex for, quote, new scoops, unquote. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has threatened legal action against Warner Brothers Studio and says there is no evidence that this ever happened and called the film's suggestion that Scruggs traded sex for news tips offensive and deeply troubling in the Me Too era. Warner Brothers and Olivia Wilde defend the moment in the film. Wilde had this to say: I think it's a shame that she's been reduced to one inferred moment in the film. It happens a lot to women. We're expected to be one-dimensional if we are to be considered feminists. Is this important? Do you care?
What's important is now I got to put Olivia Wilde in my Scarlett Johansson box. Like, I assumed she took this because I get, like, Clint Eastwood, sure. He's directed people to Oscars. Like, sure. I get it. But the one-handedness and the villainy that this journalist, this female journalist represents
in
that movie.
An actual person.
Is so, it's over the top. Like, she might as well be like Ursula with like two eels as henchmen. But that it is a real life person and tying in a journalist who trades sex for like new scoops is so offensive. And also, this woman has passed away since this happened. Right. Like, she can't defend herself.
She
did, they did fight it legally since then. And like, not the movie, but the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, where I believe Alonzo interned at one
it's
point.
It's true. My summer between my junior and senior year of college.
There you go. Oh. That when the newspaper had fought against the accusations at the time, and it was never proven, like, that there was anything substantiating them. So it's
collusion
already,
between them and the FBI.
Yeah, so it's already been sort of batted away. To take a real-life person, which I think is the heart of this, because we've talked before about, like, integrating real-life stories and fictional accounts and how you blend
the headlines
them.
And, yeah.
Yeah, and to take that and to put on something that I think just perpetuates such a negative stereotype, which is I hate that phrase, but oh, just ugliness.
Well, and let's face it. I think, you know, Eastwood is coming from a place also where, like, you just made Sully, in which you completely invented from whole cloth this whole, like, fake investigation where they were out to get him, and that none of which ever happened, just to sort of underscore your kind of libertarian, big government is out to get us and crush the white man who's doing heroic deeds. And frankly, the timing of making a movie about an innocent man who is railroaded by the FBI and an uncaring media publishing fake news while the impeachment is going on is just like, yeah. Thanks, Clint.
Go talk to another chair,
see what,
Clint.
We see what you're doing.
Yeah, no, like I mean, you know, very similar to, you know, the Golden Globes discussion. It's very true that sometimes, you know, I'll hold my tongue about certain folks because, you know, I am in the industry. Clint Eastwood is not one of those people. Fuck Clint Eastwood. I don't like Clint Eastwood. I've never really had love for him. I really decided fuck him when he decided to have a debate with an empty chair. I think he's a piece of shit. I think he makes propaganda, and I think he's the only one of the few people who gets away with making it because he has such a storied career that it can almost be seen as like, oh, well, he's just trying to be artistic. No, he's not. He's making propaganda, and I think you're 1,000% right, Alonzo. I think this is supposed to mirror what's going on with Trump, and there's always innocent white men. It's always an excuse to use slurs against, you know, people of color. Now, this shit's for the birds. And also, I think it's super disrespectful when you're talking about a real person to infer that at all. And I'm so sad Olivia Wilde's getting caught up in this nonsense because she's probably just trying to cover her ass because who wants to make an old white man in Hollywood mad, you know? Well, me. Fuck you, Clint Eastwood.
Wow.
And you know, speaking of Olivia's, I think she doesn't want to be the Olivia Munn in this.
Yeah.
You remember Olivia Munn spoke out about all this, the stuff that was going on with Predator. And I think, you know, that she is probably officially or unofficially thought of as trouble.
Yeah.
You know, for speaking up about stuff.
All right. So Dame Maggie Smith, you all. That's how I say y'all. You all, Dame Maggie Smith does her work on Harry Potter and Downton Abbey wasn't what you would call satisfying. That was not like a very good Maggie Smith, but it was my Maggie Smith. So in a recent interview with the Evening Standard, Dame Maggie Smith had to say this about her involvement with Downton Abbey and Harry Potter. "I'm deeply grateful for the work in Potter and indeed Downton, but it wasn't what you'd call satisfying. I didn't really feel I was acting in those things," which is kind of wonderful thinking about just that. Like, oh, that's just how I spend my day.
Yeah.
She goes on to admit the only reason she took those roles because there wasn't much happening for her in the theater world.
Aww.
"I wanted to get back to the stage so much because theater is basically my favorite medium, and I think I felt as though I'd left it all unfinished, but there wasn't anything that came along. Is this important? Do you care?"
Yes, hired. She's right there, alive and good. Put her on a stage. Write a play for her. Okay.
Well, don't you want her to have stage-worthy roles in movies so everyone could see her that doesn't live in London?
We have come a really long way in how we're filming stage productions, and I feel like
it could be a Phantom event.
Broadway has the Phantom event. Broadway's working on a streaming app.
Oh, Broadway HD. There is one.
Yeah. So there's a lot of possibilities if where she wants to be is the stage, but I think we. As like Western society at large, we don't appreciate our grandmas, and it really bothers me. The fact that we have only had the one grandma in A Star Is Born out of four remakes when she was clearly the best character. Like, Maggie Smith could have been grandma in this one. Ugh. I just feel like she should
Maggie Smith
to
should
do.
Be as busy as Clint Eastwood.
Yes. Probably.
I think in these two specific projects, though, I mean, like, yes, Downton, she is basically there to, like, fire off the zingers.
What is a weekend?
Exactly. And if you've watched Tea with the Dames, and if you haven't,
I love that movie
go do
so
that
much.
Right now,
we played
then you
that
know
in LA Film Fest.
She can do it in her sleep. Like, that is yeah. that is not a any kind of effort. And then if you're playing one of the professors at Hogwarts in a Harry Potter movie, that's a lot of tea breaks. You know, that's a lot of like showing up and offering mostly exposition and then yeah. getting
she
off.
She got to do a Scottish accent. I mean, yeah, sure. That's got to count for something.
She could probably do it in her sleep
and
too.
And I'm hoping what it means too is that when she is doing theater, she's offered really interesting roles. Well, and these are both huge ensemble pieces where she does. She gets rolled in for like you're going to have this quick exchange with these 15 other characters.
And then out.
And then you're out again. Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, then Maggie, I hear you. So this is an open offer. I'm writing a play. It's called Give Me My Baby Back. It's about when, the British colonizes Nigeria and they steal my son. And I travel all the way to London to get my son back. You are my son's foster mother and you are in love with my son.
At 90.
Yes. And you don't want to give my son back. So let's collab, Maggie. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking about Queen and Slim, just as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on Maximum Fun.
Hi, it's me, April Wolf, the host of Switchblade Sisters and co-writer of the new horror film, Black Christmas.
And I'm Katie Walsh, film critic and occasional host of Switchblade Sisters.
We're here to announce that for one episode, we will be doing something a little different. Much like Jeff Goldblum and David Cronenberg's The Fly, I will be going through a truly disturbing transformation.
April will transform from the interviewer into the interviewee. I will be asking her all about her new film, Black Christmas, her writing process, and ongoing existential dread.
But I will also be discussing John Carpenter's perfect masterpiece, Prince of Darkness.
You guys seen any movies you like?
So tune in to Switchblade Sisters for a one-of-a-kind episode with April Wolf and me, Katie Walsh.
See you then.
Only the corrupt I listen to now.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Wadiwe. In the studio with me are
Drea Clark,
Joelle Monique,
Alonzo Duraldi.
And today we're talking Queen and Slim. And I'm going to be providing the synopsis of this film. So the film starts out with two strangers on a date, on a Tinder date, Queen and Slim. And on the way back to drop off Queen, the police gets out and they're doing what police do, which is harassing black people. Things escalate, and Slim ends up shooting the cop dead, and they decide to run for it. So now they're on the run, trying to make it somewhere where they can actually finally be free. People help them along the way. Some people are snitches. And it all ends up in a rousing finale, which...
Rousing?
Yeah, that's a word I'll use for it. A rousing finale.
Rousing for somebody.
Oh no.
Oh man. I mean, Yeah, there's so much to talk about. I guess we'll start off with the Bonnie and Clyde comparison that the film just decides to say itself, like with the line with the uncle, he was the Bonnie and Clyde. And I'll just also counter that question with someone's response online, which was, Bonnie and Clyde were criminals, Queen and Slim are not.
I think the Bonnie and Clyde thing is sort of the catch-all term that we give to the sort of like lovers on the run, the,
yes,
you know, sort of fugitive couples.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they, you know, no one's going to call them, oh, they're the Pierrot LeFou, you know.
I feel like you would call them that.
Not even me. No, but like, you know, in fact, you know, when Warren Beatty was making Bonnie and Clyde in the 60s, he the original people that they offered it to were François Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard, because like Breathless and Pierrot LeFou and a lot of these other films fit in that category. And it's not so much about these two bank robbers during the Depression in Texas, but these sort of like grandly romantic slash violent stories about, you know, lovers eluding the law and, you know, and yeah, I mean, that goes back, like you see in noir, there's like They Live by Night and a lot of films that kind of cover that thing. So yeah, there's not a causal link, but it is a category link,
yeah,
I guess.
Well, and there's something too that so many people who reference Bonnie and Clyde now never saw that movie.
Yeah.
The cultural impact it has is a visual more than a story, or even as people who probably don't know that it was based on a real life couple.
True.
Yeah.
So I think that, yeah, it's worrisome to me if someone's considering them criminals, because as much as there is a criminal act of sorts that kicks off why they go on the run.
Mm-hmm.
They're not criminals to me. That's part of what we're digging into with this movie, right?
Yeah.
But I think that the shorthand of it, and like Melina Matsoukas, the director, also did like this sizzle reel for when Beyonce and Jay-Z went on tour, and they did their On the Run tour, and that was also very Bonnie and Clyde style.
She directed all the stuff from Lemonade.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of it, yeah, a lot of the visual iconography for it is much more about like, oh, this stylish couple who has like a dark and whatever, but less of...
I mean, there is the thing about Bonnie and Clyde where like they were bank robbers in the Depression and banks were the bad guys because they were taking away people's land. And so it's like, you know, you could draw the link between like, they have technically committed the crime of shooting this guy, but it was justifiable, and it's part of a larger context of crimes being committed by one powerful entity against the powerless.
Yeah.
And they're striking back against it. And so that sort of acts as a parallel, but yeah, not everything has to be through that filter.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I want to kind of bounce off of what you were saying about the director, because that was one of the things that I think really shone for me in the movie. I think visually, this movie was really great. You know, I really liked, you know, a lot of the choices they made, the colors and everything. There were some choices that felt like they were done just because it would look
good
visually.
For the visual, sure.
Which we can get into more later. But I don't know. What did you think, Joelle? Joelle, you've been thinking.
Yeah.
You've been doing a lot of thinking. And
it's a film that requires much contemplation.
Can we dig... normally we don't speak chronologically, but I'd love to do our little spoiler pocket at the end about the end.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Just
keep it clean.
Tuck that into our armpits.
That's
that
spoiler pocket halfway, because I'm going to need to talk.
Okay. Melina is pivoting out of her music video career, which has lasted over a decade. And she also does like these beautiful editorials. And I feel like you could really compare her first film to Tom Ford's first film as far as just style, the way that she's exploring landscapes, the way she frames people, especially in the club. Oh my God, I could watch that scene on a loop. It is so beautiful.
Did it remind
you
at all, speaking of music video, Mark Romanek did a Janet Jackson video for so many years ago that I'll...
Does it feel so right?
Nope. I'm going to have to look it up. It was at a Jamaican dance hall, so it was all beautifully lit black bodies, but like it had the same visual thing as Melina's dance scene.
I felt just a lot of cultural touchstones in that specific scene. I think as far as the Bonnie and Clyde thing goes, you could even, Jordan Sailors did a really good job of comparing it to a lot of Bonnie and Clyde type films, specifically Thelma and Louise. And I think one of the key components missing that makes those movies really compelling is the couples start off in love and very much devoted to one another and willing to die for one another, like from get. And there's an element of that missing, like the part of this journey is like, getting we're falling in love over time, but it doesn't hit for me the same way, I think, because that emotional like rock connection isn't there. And then there's like all these outside forces attacking it. It's more sort of like lackadaisical journey. Yeah.
Separate from that, I had a lot of questions about racial depictions in this because they're doing so much. Lena Waithe wrote the story with like a story by James Fry. Yeah,
apparently James Fry sort of gave her like an outline of an idea and then she wrote the whole
thing. She ran with it. But there were several things in me that I'm like, huh, like I fully acknowledge I operate from a large position of white guilt much of the time. And in this, there were things that I was like, ooh, I don't know. Is that? I don't know if I feel great about that. And one of them.
We might as well come out and talk about it. We're talking about the lovable.
No, even before we get to the ending, for me.
Oh, not even the ending. Ending. Oh, we're talking about the lovable pimp? Are we talking about that character?
Well, there's a lovable pimp, but there's also like, there's a love scene intercut with a black kid
who's getting murdered.
But also shooting and perpetuating a crime. Mm-hmm. And then you have like a friendly cop that sort of like helps them out. And so there's like all these dips and turns. And I was like, are they trying to be all... do you know what I mean? Like this.
I want to unpack this part too, because this is the one thing where the movie loses me. Like, I think it's got two great first acts and a great ending, but okay. So this is spoiler time. So jump ahead if you don't want to hear this. So they stop to get the car worked on. The kid of the mechanic recognizes them, thinks they're awesome. You know, goes to a protest that
because
day
because they've gone viral.
Exactly. Like the video, the body cam video of the cop has gone viral.
Yeah.
So he goes to a protest that day and it becomes violent, and the kid winds up pulling a gun on a black cop and shooting him.
Yeah.
And then not that much longer later in the film, they are trying, the cops are showing up in the neighborhood where they're in. It doesn't look like they're going to get away, and they only get away because another black cop spots them and sort of waves them on and lets them go away.
Yeah, but let's not forget the heavy-handed racism that cop dealt with.
The white cop, yes.
Well, and that's what's funny is like, wow, you kind of like gave away the twist here, because the moment he's like, don't call me boy, and he's gone, I'm like, oh, he's going to let them go because he's if anything, I would have, I mean, I don't want to say for me, what would have worked like a little better is if we don't know that about the cop, we don't know their dynamic, and then we have that suspense, he lets them go, and then we have that racist interaction, and it's like, oh
that's why.
Yeah.
But see, what baffled me though was, first of all, I thought like the kid shooting the cop was already like, whoa, that's a big step, and that's a, you know, we're going for something dramatic here, and I'll work with that. But then when you get to the cop letting them go, I'm like, if the kid had killed a white cop, maybe, but the fact that the kid killed a black cop in the defense of these two people, and another black cop is okay with letting them go, walk me through that, because that's where it lost me, but maybe that's on me.
So here's, Lena Waithe is trying to do what Spike Lee did on Do the Right Thing, which is to take archetypes of characters from within the black community, Spike Lee, within the black community across America. So she explained that like Slim and Queen are supposed to be MLK and Malcolm X. Very like different opinions on how to achieve the same goal. As they spend more time together, their ideas get closer and closer. Then she mapped it in a reverse direction of the Underground Railroad, starting in Ohio, where Tony Rice killed, and going down to Florida. It's a lot of big ideas that don't come together. It's so vague that it's loses meaning.
This is what's interesting, and this is where we'll kind of step outside of this discussion and go for a bigger discussion, which is, you know, this has caused a big discussion.
Are we going to solve race?
Kind of. No. where this has opened a big discussion within Black Twitter, because there was the debate of whether we should support this movie blindly because, you know, it's made by a black creator. And then and we had some people attacking black critics who didn't like it. Like, it's a disservice to black art if we don't say are like truly.
If you give it all a pass.
Yeah, if you give it all a pass. And I think that we are at a point in media. I mean, it can be so much more. There can be so much more. But I think the floodgates are starting to open for black cinema, where it's not just black cinema. We're not looking at this like Tales from the Hood. I think a general audience came to see this. So I think that means you could take the foot off the gas and really look at this. And I think also, as creatives, Lena Waithe should be free to explore this and maybe, you know, misstep and not a hit for some people versus, you know, her playing it safe and doing what, you know, she knows works, you know.
Can I ask, as you know, in as we get to the end of the ultimate spoiler of the ending,
yeah,
is where I had the biggest pause in terms of, ooh, I don't know if I feel great about that messaging, but also I would never be the one to be like, those women shouldn't make that. They can make whatever messaging they want, and I applaud them for it. But Brixie Obi in Shadow and Act wrote a review that I resonated very strongly with me in about the ending, because the end of this movie, you've seen these people who've been helped and hindered along the way, and they're trying to escape to Cuba, a la Assata Shakur, and ultimately they're killed by cops, and it's a very big visual, and it's sacrificial.
Yeah, it's very glamorized. I think that's the perfect word. And I thought of the soundbite that I was going to say about that on my way here. I'm going to take us back to Get Out, where Jordan Peele talked about the end of the movie, where he originally was going to have him be arrested or killed, but he said the reason he didn't do that is he didn't want the audience to experience him going through all that only to be, you know, have this bad ending. And I remember hearing that and being like, oh, I don't see what the problem with that would be. And then I saw this and I was like, yeah, we watch them go through so much. We go through so much as the audience for them to just end up being gunned down. It kind of just, it doesn't feel good. Like,
let's not forget how Bonnie and Clyde ends.
Yeah. Right. But it's also, I guess for me, and why I like Brixie Obi's writing of it, was the idea of, if you finally get to be the one telling your own story, and in the media we are blasted all of the time with unnecessarily violent death at the hands of cops by black people, and so to make your own story and end it that way, that's just such a big decision.
So I love Brooke, first of all. She's amazing.
I love her, too.
She's so smart. We actually saw this movie together the second time I watched it. And going in, I was like, I hate this movie. She was like, really? I was like, hated it the first. I hate it. And then afterwards, she was like, oh, I see why you didn't like it. I'm like, I actually kind of like it now. My opinion flipped on the second watch. And here's why. I feel like when we tell our own stories, we frequently are looking for a happy ending because it's something we don't get in life. Fair. I think some of our better films about black pain and suffering have come from people who've done a little more research on the actual movements. Ava DuVernay and Ryan Coogler's Fruitvale Station come to mind. There's a lot of nuance in how those scenes are depicted that we don't really get here. However, the phrase, it be your own people, is like black legend. You know, this idea of like, it could, like, you can't trust, not all skin folk are kin folk. These are common phrases. And so I think to suggest that we're not telling our own stories because, you know, they're violent, or to suggest that by telling the violence that it typically happens to us, that we're somehow doing a disservice to our community, I don't think that's fair. I do think it's fair to say that we only commodify the deaths, that after someone is killed, the only thing that happens is murals go up and t-shirts are sold. I found the entire like last 5 minutes of just funeral and all these people we've never met before and like hyper visualization of like black memorials, which we see a lot, without investigating how movements take place after deaths, specifically after the 2014, when the three kids died in 2014 by police. There's so much more to say and explore that I think got kind of lost in, again, many of the messages they were trying to tell.
Yeah.
I think that's also a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. Yeah. If they get away, then you get accused mm-hmm. of like, oh, you're letting the audience off the hook. You're not being true to the times we live in and what happens to people when they have encounters with the police, even under innocuous circumstances. And then if you do kill them, then, why are you presenting these negative stories of our people? And why, now that we're in the driver's seat, we should be able to win one of these. And so, I think they were in an uncomfortable position where whatever they did was going to get criticized.
Yeah. Definitely. And I don't think necessarily because I feel bad at the end of the movie, it makes it a bad movie. And I think 90% of quote unquote film Twitter does not understand this. Oh, this could all often turn to my end of the year film Twitter rant, but we don't have time because we have to give our votes on whether you think you should screen it, stream it, or skip it.
I think you should screen it personally. Mm-hmm. I think I say this every time, but you vote with your box office dollars, and this is the kind of inventive, challenging filmmaking that I like to see rewarded. And I also think there's so much to both enjoy and to take away from this movie.
When Melina Matsoukas is in her bag filming, getting beautiful shots, oh my gosh, this movie is so great to look at.
And it makes such a difference having someone who regularly shoots black skin, like how they're mm-hmm. shot in different settings, like, I mean, it's beautiful.
Even black locations, which are typically filmed as like dirtier, lesser than, she brings like a very regal beauty to these spaces, which I think is important. Daniel Kaluuya is really working with this. That man is an actor, okay? Yeah. Like, he is pulling out performance.
Oh my God.
And so if you just want to go watch his beautiful face be amazing, totally worth it. I would say if you can screen it outside, do that. It's a film that visually is very just open. She has these really gorgeous landscape shots, and I just felt a different I had a different experience watching it outside that I really enjoyed, and I think other people might too. So if you can, do that.
Yeah, I say screen it. I want to mention Tat Radcliffe, the cinematographer, who I think really, as you guys were saying, the way he shoots black skin, black people, is really gorgeous. We haven't mentioned Jodie Turner-Smith, who co-stars
amazing.
With Kaluuya, who's great. India Moore, I think, gives a terrific supporting performance.
Bokeem Woodbine.
I have issues with this movie, but I'm thrilled that it exists. I want to see more movies like it. And just strictly for the visual sense of it, absolutely, if you can see it on a big screen, you totally should.
I'm going to say screen, but there's so much I want to say because it is so interesting because we've done this before, and I do wonder if sometimes people are like, man, I thought they didn't like that movie. They had that long discussion, and then they're all saying screen it. But I think that's the beauty of cinema. Yeah, I'm going to go full film Twitter on this And I think it's that the full experience of watching film isn't just watching it and holding your thoughts to yourself. I highly recommend going with friends, having a movie club to have these discussions, because even if a movie's not you like everything about it, it's great for the discussion. I mean, I think most of the people in my friend circle hated Mother, and I loved it. And my favorite part was hearing why you didn't like it. Because that, like I said, I'm going to make my way back to film tour. Because that makes a good, talking point for film. Like, I don't care if you think it sucks and if you got a funny joke to dunk on a movie, because look, I'm a comedian, I will always have better jokes than you. So like, no need to just dunk on movies. Like, tell me why you didn't like it, go into details, because that is good film intelligence. We were making it way too cool in 2020, the new decade. Let's make it cool to have actual discussions about films and not just dunking on stuff or calling it trash without any type of information of why you didn't like it. Because if you can't understand why you didn't like it, maybe you shouldn't have a YouTube channel. All right.
He had words.
Woo. A subtweet vocalized. I really appreciate it.
But I'm going to take a deep breath, and then after that, we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Hey, if you like your podcast to be focused and well-researched and your podcast host to be uncharismatic, unhorny strangers who have no interest in horses, then this is not the podcast for you.
Yeah, and what's your deal? I'm Emily.
I'm Lisa.
Our show's called Baby Geniuses.
And its hosts are horny adult idiots. We discover weird Wikipedia pages every episode.
We discuss institutional misogyny.
We ask each other the dumbest questions, and our listeners won't stop sending us pictures of their butts.
We haven't asked them to stop, but they also aren't stopping.
Join us on Baby Geniuses
every other week on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, and in the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duraldi.
Joelle Monique.
Drea Clark.
And as everyone should know, the new film Black Christmas is set for a wide release this weekend.
Woo-hoo!
And it just so happens that it was co-written by one of our former hosts and beloved friends, April Wolf. Oh!
You did that.
Hi, guys.
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks for joining us. So we're going to ask you a few questions about Black Christmas and the whole filmmaking process. And does that sound okay to you?
God, I hope I'm ready. I'm ready. I've got my cat with me on my lap. I'm ready to go.
So April, a lot of times writers are sort of like they hand the script off and they're done. But you went to New Zealand. Were you there for like the whole shoot or a chunk or what was the deal?
So I was there for the month right before shooting, which is prep. And that's when your production office is assembled, when your crew comes in, and when you're, usually doing storyboards, doing all that shit, location scouting, tech scouts. But I was there, which is a different thing, because usually you've got a script that's done. But because of this being such a truncated process, we were still writing it when she went down there. And so that meant that I had to go down there. And it also meant that we got to do a lot of cool things like rewrite some action for some scenes that would be taking place in different locations. And rewriting things for instance, budget when things pop up. It was nice. Or, you know, like a props person, this woman, Sophie Durham, who's a wonderful, you know, if there's a prop that doesn't work in a kill, then, you know, we have the choice to rewrite that and she can make a new prop. There's just a lot of cool things that you can do when that process is actually so short.
Well, if it makes you feel better, White Christmas was also being rewritten while they were like already building the sets and like rehearsing the dance numbers.
April, I have a question. This is Drea Clark, White Bear Lake Gazette. A question for you. Would you consider Black Christmas to be an elevated horror or just like a regular horror?
Or is it lowered?
Or just like lower horror?
It is like the lowest brow horror you could imagine. Is that a real question?
No, it's not. I just wanted to say the words elevated horror to you. I know that you have an insane knowledge of the horror genre. Mm. Did you, when you were crafting this and figuring out your budgetary kill changes, were there any certain, beyond the original Black Christmas, were there any influences you took in mind?
Exorcist 3.
Ooh.
I need you to get more specific.
I know exactly what moment you mean, I think.
And I would say, for me, I was thinking about Prince of Darkness, which is also something that I'll be talking about this week on Switchblade Sisters with Katie Walsh.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, we get the plug. Fine.
I know. And then, Sophia had come in also with Eyes Wide Shut in her head,
nice.
Too.
Okay.
Some kinds of adventure fare also. And, there's quite a few. I'm trying to think of like more of it. I don't want to give too much away, but we were looking at like a lot of classic stuff. Not necessarily the kind of giallo stuff that the original Black Christmas was drawing from, because there's a certain kind of suspense that they're using, that Bob Clark was using at that. We were kind of looking at some campy horror classics actually. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what's going to set some of our themes apart.
Nice. Tickets okay. Sold.
Yeah. This is Ify. Ify chiming in right now.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going? Is this movie too scary for me and Alonzo?
No. I think that is equal parts scary and fun, and that we're really trying to get people into the theater who also maybe aren't big horror fans, because we hope that they will laugh at a few jokes.
It's a gateway film.
Yeah.
Yeah. So hopefully, you know, like they'll just feel like a kind of like surge of energy, like, oh, this is very fun. It's not, I think that it can meld with a range of people's tastes in horror.
I need to know, in the whole process, when, like, you know, the deal's being made and you can't talk about it and you have to keep it a secret, how hard was it for you to stare at me, a Christmas movie expert, and not tell me that you were doing this goddamn movie?
That was pretty hard. That was really hard. I felt like I was betraying you. Maybe that's too soft. I felt like we had gotten a divorce. It felt really bad.
Well, I forgive you.
And not in a fun way.
Thank you for joining us, April. Can you tell us again when we should go see Black Christmas?
Friday the 13th.
Oh, that's so good.
I got to say, people need to go and see it that first weekend or that first week, because Star Wars is going to punch our tits in.
I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, what is that? A new indie film? Yeah.
So you're saying this is tits to the glass then?
Yes. Everyone needs to be tits to the glass.
Yeah.
Congratulations,
well, thank you so
April.
Much for talking, guys.
Yeah,
we're so proud of you.
We are so proud.
I'm so proud of you. That was.
I know your voice because I heard you sing karaoke.
Merry Black Christmas, April.
Yay, Merry Black Christmas.
And especially Black Merry Black Christmas from me. Time to keep the Christmas train choo choo choo. Hoeing down the street, and it's time for everyone's
hoeing down the street.
Yeah, I just realized
that the whole thing happened.
Yeah, I tried to blow past.
As it were.
No, that's
it. Just you're digging it deeper.
That's it.
All right, now it's time for everyone's favorite segment, the Christmas Zaddy Christmas Movie Minute. Our Christmas Zaddy, Alonzo Duralde, will quickly list all of the Christmas movies that he's seen this past week in under a minute. And if this segment doesn't quench your thirst for Christmas movies, you can check out his book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. And like I said, I am checking your Amazon checkouts. If you don't do it, I'm coming down your chimney. And not in the hot way.
You don't know any other way. Yeah.
Alonzo, are you ready?
Oh, let's do it.
All right, Casey, hit it!
Okay, Ghosting the Spirit of Christmas on Freeform, actual lesbian couple, they were the B couple, but still, it was really good. It was quite charming. Christmas Prince, Royal Baby, Netflix just knows what they're doing with these. Totally ridiculous, but I loved it anyway. Check Into Christmas on Hallmark, super bland for the most part. Christmas at Dollywood, we don't get Dolly Parton until the last like 10 minutes, and she does not sing, boo to that. A Christmas Love Story, kind of mezzo-mezzo, but you know, why am I blanking on her name? The wonderful Broadway star and from Pushing Daisies. Anyway, her, you know.
Krista Chenoweth.
Krista Chenoweth, yes, so she makes this thing work. Mistletoe and Menorahs on Lifetime. It's exactly what it sounds like, and damn if it doesn't work, especially because Jake Epstein is one of my favorite Degrassi graduates. Baking Christmas on OWN, much better than the first one that they did. Almost qualifies as a real movie, like if it had had a budget, even though Fred Olin Ray directed it, it could have been a thing. Also, TV-wise, there's Moody Christmas on Fox, pretty funny, good ensemble. And then Merry Happy Whatever on Netflix, good ensemble, terrible laugh track, couldn't make it past one episode. Okay.
Krista Chenoweth almost sunk you.
I don't know why that just flew out of my head.
Oh, man.
She's a doll.
Now it's time for staff picks. It could be any movie, in theater, streaming, what have you. Joelle, you're our guest, so why don't you start us off?
Ava DuVernay-Zeray has recently acquired Numa Perrier's Jezebel, and if y'all don't watch it, we could fight. It is... Y'all don't understand. Numa Perrier mined her late childhood, early teens. Her mother is sick. She's living with her sister and her sister's weird boyfriend and her younger siblings in an apartment. And then she becomes a phone sex operator. And then she's like, they try to recruit her to porn. She's like 19. Like, it is such a deep delve into what it is to be a sex worker, how these girls are corralled into this industry, what it is like to be empowered and in that industry. It is beautifully told. The performances are amazing. Numa plays her own older sister, which is mind-blowing. I have an interview with her that I'm really trying to find a good place for. I can't recommend it enough. I think she has so many more great stories to tell, and I can't wait to watch them. Numa Perrier's Jezebel. It's on Netflix on the 16th, I want to say it drops.
Mm. I'll back that up. It's also the only depiction I've seen of camgirl in movies that took a total different track than you normally see. Like you mentioned her being empowered by it and this interesting mixture of how she handles what she's doing.
The way they train one another to work within the confines of the industry is really fascinating to watch. There's just a lot of culture that I don't think has been explored on film yet, and she does it so beautifully, and it's her first feature, and I'm just really proud of her, and I want the movie to do really well.
Drea, do you have a staff pick?
I do. I also have a one-word indie. It's a film called Colwell that's directed by Tom Quinn. I programmed it at Bentonville Film Fest last year, and I programmed previous early work of him at the LA Film Festival. It comes out on Blu-ray and on demand and all that on December 12th, so the day before this comes out. And it's also recently been nominated. It stars Karen Allen, and who was nominated for a Spirit Award for her performance in this. And one of the things is so striking is it takes place in this very small town, I think in Pennsylvania, and she plays the postmaster of the town, and it's like the post office is sort of run out of her house, and it's kind of a gathering place because it's a real small farm community. And it touches on both the dying out of small towns, but also how elderly people, like Karen Allen is now in her 60s, and the idea of feeling obsolete or, you know, living in a world where you have less and less value. And as a woman, and she's a woman by herself, and it's so beautifully done. And I was thrilled that they got a nomination. Like, it is a very tiny indie film. So Colwell.
Oh, Colwell. All right. And, you know, mine, you know, is...
Space Jam.
No, close. What Men Want. I actually, that one was out of the three movies I watched, really surprised me. I mean, it took a while to get going, but when it got to the point, like also in the...
That's Taraji, right?
Yeah. In What Women Want, who's the guy?
Mel Gibson.
And he's like a ladies' man, right?
Yeah.
So I feel like they should have just did that with Taraji, because like they try and do the played out thing of like, oh, she just works too hard. It's like, no, give me a woman who works too hard and I'll do whatever she wants. Food ready when you get home. Kids tucked in. I'm in my male lingerie, whatever that is. Give me that. That is never going to be a bad thing for me at the beginning of the movie. It will always make my disbelief fuck all the way off. I'm like, no, fuck that. But she was also, which was a real funny device, bad at sex because she like just did what she wanted. And those scenes were like very funny and like slapsticky, but it was like, if that was it, if she was just banging dudes and just was bad at it, through all that, it's such a fun laugh, and I think it'll be probably anywhere on any stream cable platform. But watch
or
it.
Airplane.
I truly, out of the three movies, Venom, What Men Want, and Stuber, that was the one that was like, oh. I probably would have gave this a screen it.
So my pick, TCM every year like unpacks the fun stuff for Christmas. And so I just want to kind of point out a couple things that are coming up this Sunday, December 15th. They've got It Happened on Fifth Avenue, which is a 40s comedy that is a lot of fun. But it's funny. It's the movie that Frank Capra considered making after World War II before instead doing It's a Wonderful Life. And one of the writers of this movie did indeed get called up in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee because it is so much a movie about like collectivism defeating rich people. Basically this guy, this millionaire goes to the South or whatever during the winter, and this homeless guy moves into his mansion and lives there, and he winds up taking in all these other people, these like ex-GIs movie. And stuff. And it's literally this sort of like collective paradise that transpires. It's a really charming movie. It's really funny. And then that night they're showing Holiday Affair with Robert Mitchum and Janet Leigh, which is wonderful. And Remember the Night, which is this great Fred McMurray, Barbara Stanwyck comedy that is the last movie that Preston Sturges wrote but didn't direct. It's just really delightful. And it's only in recent years become like available on home video and stuff. So like I think a lot of people still haven't seen it. It's great. And then if you happen to catch it on December 22nd, they're rerunning the special A Night at the Movies, Merry Christmas, where they talk about the history of Christmas movies with a lot of experts. Including
who?
Including.
Those are my favorites.
I love it. So, you know, if you want to see the Christmas Zaddy, you get to see you and all your...
Yeah, my hair was darker then, but, you know.
Same general vibe.
What are you gonna
do? Yeah. You get the same vibes. Before we go, let's read a five-star review. If you leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts, we'll read it on air. This one comes from L... Michaela 94. I don't really like movie podcasts. Maybe because I'm not much of a film fanatic. I'll go and see big titles I'm excited about, but usually I'm a TV person. But I love the energy of this show. The host and the guest are all wonderful, even if one put me on low-key blast for not knowing Pennywise was more than a clown. Oh, I know who this is. This is Geek Create. What you should have known. and the discussions are lively, and best of all, they let me know if I have to go see a movie or if I can wait for it to come to streaming. A great show, even for someone who doesn't typically enjoy this genre of podcast. Well, thank you so much.
Can I throw in one small thing? I went and looked at our reviews recently, and I can't remember why. It was for a reason beyond just vanity. But the first and few of the one stars I came back, the entirety of it just said, more liberal nonsense.
Oh, yeah.
Yay. And I was like, oh, we're getting it done.
You did it right.
Oh, yeah. We've accomplished it.
Good.
Success.
Joelle. Thank you for being on the show. Where can people find you? Anything to plug?
Oh my gosh, so much. wait, does this drop tomorrow?
Friday.
Oh my gosh, you have 48 hours to catch up on the greatest show of this decade, Watchmen. Do it. Oh. Go home.
Can I put a plug in for Joelle here?
Oh.
Joelle is writing Watchmen recap reviews, and they are transcendent. And so please watch Watchmen, and if you already are, please read what she's writing about it.
So good
she's
the
doing
likes
the Lord's
of
work.
Issa Rae be retweeting.
Oh, for real?
It.
Yeah. Yeah, you deserve that. You're doing great stuff.
Thank you. The AV Club, which is where the reviews are, they live there. That community is everything to me. If you want to comment and share your wonderful knowledge, and I the comic books and the movie history and Black history I get, but some of y'all are getting into some superhero history where I was like, wow, I'm blown away. This is amazing. Also, I have an interview with Kelly Marie Tran and Naomi Aki. Coming out with Bustle that I think we're all going to be talking about for a while. If you've ever wanted to just sit in on two women getting started in the industry and hear all of the challenges, oh my gosh, I'm really excited to talk to you guys about this interview. So you can check that out. I think it drops Monday. Other than that, I live on Twitter 16 hours a day, so come find me at Joelle Monique.
All right.
Oh, and hey, while we're plugging, just real quick, if you're in Los Angeles this weekend, Sunday the 15th is Christmasland Experience.
You're going to be there?
You better experience some Christmasland with me in it. I'm going to be hanging out with the Deck the Hallmark guys in the Dan Cave. I will be selling and signing books. Nikki DeLoach is going to be there. There's going to be craft cocktails and photo op things and a gingerbread contest and it's all the things.
Where is this?
It's at the Fig House.
What?
ChristmaslandExperience.com. Sunday, December 15th. Come get it. Tickets are on sale.
A slice of magic. Wow. Wow.
For all you who aren't in LA.
Yeah, I might have to pull up. You had me at Zaddy, but now I'm going to get Shalatty with those cocktails. And you still have time before Christmas to buy your Who Shot Your Ornament. Just go to MaxFunStore.com and pick one up. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Your Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYourPodcast or send us an email at WhoShotYourPodcast@MaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
More liberal nonsense.
Yes.
Please.
MaximumFun.org. Comedy and Culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.